Darling, I won't get a chance to post another letter for a while. This is the last time before we take to the hills, the Brooks Range. The archaeologists are fizzing to get up there. One chap is convinced he'll find evidence of much earlier habitation than anyone suspected. I said how much earlier, and why was he convinced? He told me of some narwhal ivory carvings he'd found on a previous dig, carbon 14 dated to some incredible age, way outside the range of what was previously assumed. Anomalous, in fact. Wouldn't it be strange if they'd come through my anomaly from some other world? Talking of which, the physicist Nelson is my closest buddy now, kids me along, drops hints to imply that he knows that I know that he knows, etc. And I pretend to be bluff Major Parry, stout fellow in a crisis, but not too much between the ears, what? But I know he's after it. For one thing, although he's a bona fide academic, his funding actually comes from the Ministry of Defence. I know the financial codes they use. And for another, his so-called weather balloons are nothing of the sort. I looked in the crate. A radiation suit, if ever I've seen one. A rum do, my darling. I shall stick to my plan. Take the archaeologists to their spot, and go off by myself for a few days to look for the anomaly. If I bump into Nelson wandering about on Lookout Ridge, I'll play it by ear. Later, a real bit of luck. I met Jake Peterson's pal, the Eskimo, Matt Kigalik. Jake had told me where to find him, but I hadn't dared to hope he'd be there. He told me the Soviets had been looking for the anomaly, too. He'd come across a man earlier this year, high up in the range, and watched him for a couple of days without being seen, because he guessed what he was doing, and he was right. And the man turned out to be Russian, a spy. He didn't tell me more than that. I got the impression he bumped him off, but he described the thing to me. It's like a gap in the air, a sort of window. You look through it, and you see another world. But it's not easy to find, because that part of the other world looks just like this, rocks and moss and so forth. It's on the north side of a small creek, 50 paces or so to the west of a tall rock shaped like a standing bear. And the position Jake gave me is not quite right. It's nearer 12 seconds north than 11. Wish me luck, my darling. I'll bring you back a trophy from the spirit world. I love you forever. Kiss the boy for me. Johnny.
Will found his head ringing. His father was describing exactly what he himself had found under the hornbeam trees. He, too, had found a window. He even used the same word for it. So Will must be on the right track. And this knowledge was what the men had been searching for. So it was dangerous, too. Will had been just a baby when that letter was written. 7 years after that had come the morning in the supermarket when he realized his mother was in terrible danger, and he had to protect her. And then, slowly in the months that followed, came his growing realization that the danger was in her mind, and he had to protect her all the more. And then, brutally, the revelation that not all the danger had been in her mind after all. There really was someone after her, after these letters, this information. He had no idea what it meant, but he felt deeply happy that he had something so important to share with his father. That John Parry and his son Will had each, separately, discovered this extraordinary thing. When they met, they could talk about it, and his father would be proud that Will had followed in his footsteps. The night was quiet and the sea was still. He folded the letters away and fell asleep.
Chapter 6. Lighted Flares.
Grumman,
said the black-bearded fur trader.
From the Berlin Academy? Reckless. I met him 5 years back, over at the northern end of the Urals. I thought he was dead.
Sam Cancino, an old acquaintance and a Texan like Lee Scoresby, sat in the naphtha-laden smoky bar of the Samyursky Hotel and tossed back a shot glass of bitingly cold vodka. He nudged the plate of pickled fish and black bread towards Lee, who took a mouthful and nodded for Sam to tell him more.
He'd walked into a trap that fool Yakov Lev laid, and cut his leg open to the bone. Instead of using regular medicines, he insisted on using the stuff the bears use, blood moss, Some kind of lichen. It ain't a true moss. Anyway, he was lying on a sledge, alternately roaring with pain and calling out instructions to his men. They were taking star sights, and they had to get the measurements right, or he'd lash them with his tongue. And boy, he had a tongue like barbed wire. A lean man, tough, powerful, curious about everything. You know, he was a Tartar by initiation.
You don't say,
said Lee Scoresby, tipping more vodka into Sam's glass. His demon, Hester, crouched at his elbow on the bar, eyes half-closed as usual, ears flat along her back. Lee had arrived that afternoon, borne to Nova Zembla by the wind the witches had called up, and once he'd stowed his equipment, he'd made straight for the Samirsky Hotel, near the fish-packing station. This was a place where many Arctic drifters stopped to exchange news or look for employment or leave messages for one another, and Lee Scoresby had spent several days there in the past, waiting for a contract or a passenger or a fair wind, so there was nothing unusual in his conduct now. And with the vast changes they sensed in the world around them, it was natural for people to gather and talk. With every day that passed came more news. The river Yenisei was free of ice, and at this time of year, too. Part of the ocean had drained away, exposing strange, regular formations of stone on the seabed. A squid 100 feet long had snatched 3 fishermen out of their boat and torn them apart. And the fog continued to roll in from the north, dense and cold and occasionally drenched with the strangest imaginable light, in which great forms could be vaguely seen and mysterious voices heard. Altogether, it was a bad time to work, which was why the bar of the Samirsky Hotel was full.
"Did you say Grewman?"
said the man sitting just along the bar, an elderly man in seal-hunter's rig, whose lemming demon looked out solemnly from his pocket.
"He was a Tartar, all right. I was there when he joined that tribe. I saw him having his skull drilled. He had another name, too, a Tartar name. I'll think of it in a minute."
"Well, how about that? Let me buy you a drink, my friend. I'm looking for news of this man. What tribe was it he joined?"
"The Yenisei Patas, at the foot of the Semyonov Range, near a fork of the Yenisei and the, I forget what it's called, the river that comes down from the hills. There's a rock the size of a house at the landing stage."
Sure, I remember it now. I've flown over it. And Grewman had his skull drilled, you say? Why was that?"
"He was a shaman. I think the tribe recognized him as a shaman before they adopted him. Some business, that drilling. It goes on for 2 nights of the day. They use a bow drill, like for lighting a fire."
"Ah, that accounts for the way his team was obeying him. They were the roughest bunch of scoundrels I ever saw, but they ran around doing his bidding like nervous children. I thought it was his cursing that did it. If they thought he was a shaman, it'd make even more sense. But you know, that man's curiosity was as powerful as a wolf's jaws. He would not let go. He made me tell him every scrap I knew about the land thereabouts and the habits of wolverines and foxes. And he was in some pain from that damn trap of Yakovlev's, leg laid open. And he was writing the results of that blood moss, taking his temperature, watching the scar form, making notes on every damn thing. A strange man. There was a witch who wanted him for a lover, but he turned her down."
"Is that so?"
said Lee, thinking of the beauty of Serafina Pekala.
"He shouldn't have done that. A witch offers you her love, you should take it. If you don't, it's your own fault if bad things happen to you. It's like having to make a choice, a blessing or a curse. The one thing you can't do is choose neither."
"He might have had a reason."
"If he had any sense, it would have been a good one."
"He was headstrong. Maybe faithful to another woman. I heard something else about him. I heard he knew the whereabouts of some magic object, I don't know what it might be, that could protect anyone who held it. Did you ever hear that story?"
"Yes, I heard that. He didn't have it himself, but he knew where it was. There was a man who tried to make him tell, but Grewman killed him."
"His demon, now that was curious. She was an eagle, a black eagle with a white head and breast, of a kind I'd never set eyes on. And I didn't know how she might be called."
"She was an osprey,"
said the barman, listening in.
"You're talking about Stan Grewman?
His demon was an osprey, a fish eagle.
What happened to him?
Oh, he got mixed up in the Skraeling Wars over at Beringland. Last I heard, he'd been shot, killed outright.
I heard they beheaded him.
No, you're both wrong. And I know, because I heard it from an Inuit who was with him. Seems that they were camped out on Sakhalin somewhere, and there was an avalanche. Grumman was buried under 100 tons of rock. This Inuit saw it happen.
What I can't understand,
said Lee Scoresby, offering the bottle round,
is what the man was doing. Was he prospecting for rock oil, maybe? Or was he a military man? Or was it something philosophical? You said something about measurements, Sam. What would that be?
They were measuring the starlight. And the aurora. He had a passion for the aurora. I think his main interest was in ruins, though.
Ancient thing.
I know who could tell you more. Up the mountain they have an observatory belonging to the Imperial Muscovite Academy. They'd be able to tell you. I know he went up there more than once.
What do you want to know for, anyway, Lee? He owes me some money.
This explanation was so satisfying that it stopped their curiosity at once. The conversation turned to the topic on everyone's lips, the catastrophic changes taking place around them which no one could see.
The fishermen, they say you can sail right up into that new world.
There's a new world?
As soon as this damn fog clears, we'll see right into it. When it first happened, I was out in my kayak and looking north, just by chance. I'll never forget what I saw. Instead of the earth curving down over the horizon, it went straight on. I could see forever. And as far as I could see, there was land and shoreline, mountains, harbors, green trees and fields of corn, forever into the sky. I tell you, friends, that was something worth toiling 50 years to see. A sight like that. I would have paddled up the sky into that calm sea without a backward glance. But then came the fog.
Ain't never seen a fog like this. Reckon it set in for a month, maybe more. But you're out of luck if you want money from Stanislaus Grumman, Lee. The man's dead.
I got his Tartar name. I just remembered what they called him during the drilling. It sounded like Jopari.
Jopari? That's no kind of name I've ever heard of. Might be Nipponese, I suppose. Well, if I want my money, maybe I can chase up his heirs and assigns. Or maybe the Berlin Academy can square the debt. I'll go ask at the observatory, see if they have an address I can apply to.
The observatory was some distance to the north, and Lee Scoresby hired a dog sledge and driver. It wasn't easy to find someone willing to risk the journey in the fog, but Lee was persuasive, or his money was. And eventually an old Tartar from the Ob region agreed to take him there, after a lengthy bout of haggling. The driver didn't rely on a compass, or he would have found it impossible. He navigated by other signs, his Arctic fox demon for one, who sat at the front of the sledge keenly scenting the way. Lee, who carried his compass everywhere, had realized already that the Earth's magnetic field was as disturbed as everything else. The old driver said, as they stopped to brew coffee,
"This happened before, this thing."
"What, the sky opening? That happened before?"
"Many thousand generation. My people remember. All long time ago. Many thousand generation."
"What did they say about it?"
"Sky fall open, and spirits move between this world and that world. All the lands move. The ice melt, then freeze again. The spirits close up the hole after a while, seal it up. But witches say the sky is thin there behind the northern lights."
"What's going to happen, Umak?"
"Same thing as before. Make all same again. But only after big trouble. Big war. Spirit war."
The driver wouldn't tell him any more, and soon they moved on, tracking slowly over undulations and hollows and past outcrops of dim rock, dark through the pallid fog, until the old man said,
"Observatory, up there. You walk now. Path too crooked for sledge. You won't go back. I wait here."
"Yeah, I want to go back when I've finished, Umak. You make yourself a fire, my friend, and sit and rest a spell. I'll be 3-4 hours, maybe.
Lee Scoresby set off, with Hester tucked into the breast of his coat, and after half an hour's stiff climb found a clump of buildings suddenly above him as if they'd just been placed there by a giant hand. But the effect was only due to a momentary lifting of the fog, and after a minute it closed in again. He saw the great dome of the main observatory, a smaller one a little way off, and between them a group of administration buildings and domestic quarters. No lights showed because the windows were blacked out permanently so as not to spoil the darkness for their telescopes. A few minutes after he arrived, Lee was talking to a group of astronomers eager to learn what news he could bring them, for there are few natural philosophers as frustrated as astronomers in a fog. He told them about everything he'd seen, and once that topic had been thoroughly dealt with, he asked about Stanislaus Grumman. The astronomers hadn't had a visitor in weeks, and they were keen to talk.
Grumman, yes, I'll tell you something about him,
said the director.
He was an Englishman, in spite of his name. I remember...
Surely not,
said his deputy.
He was a member of the Imperial German Academy. I met him in Berlin. I was sure he was German.
No, I think you'll find he was English. His command of that language was immaculate anyway. But I agree, he was certainly a member of the Berlin Academy. He was a geologist.
No, you're wrong,
said someone else.
He did look at the Earth, but not as a geologist. I had a long talk with him once. I suppose you'd call him a paleo-archaeologist.
They were sitting, 5 of them, around a table in the room that served as their common room, living and dining room, bar, recreation room, and more or less everything else. 2 of them were Muscovites, 1 was a Pole, 1 a Yoruba, and 1 a Skraeling. Lee Scoresby sensed that the little community was glad to have a visitor, if only because he introduced a change of conversation. The Pole had been the last to speak, and then the Yoruba interrupted.
What do you mean a paleo-archaeologist? Archaeologists already study what's old. Why do you need to put another word meaning old in front of it?
His field of study went back much further than you'd expect, that's all. He was looking for remains of civilizations from 20,000-30,000 years ago.
The Pole replied.
Nonsense! Utter nonsense! The man was pulling your leg. Civilizations 30,000 years old! Ha! Where is the evidence?
Under the ice! That's the point. According to Grumman, the Earth's magnetic field changed dramatically at various times in the past, and the Earth's axis actually moved, too, so that temperate areas became icebound.
How?
Said one of the Muscovites.
Oh, he had some complex theory. The point was, any evidence there might have been for very early civilizations was long since buried under the ice. He claimed to have some photographs of unusual rock formations.
Is that all?
I'm only reporting, I'm not defending him.
How long had you known Grumman, gentlemen?
Well, let me see. It was 7 years ago I met him for the first time.
He made a name for himself a year or two before that, with his paper on the variations in the magnetic pole,
said the Yoruba.
But he came out of nowhere. I mean, no one had known him as a student or seen any of his previous work.
They talked on for a while, contributing reminiscences and offering suggestions as to what might have become of Grumman, though most of them thought he was probably dead. While the Pole went to brew some more coffee, Lee's hair demon, Hester, said to him quietly,
check out the Skraeling, Lee.
The Skraeling had spoken very little. Lee had thought he was naturally taciturn, but prompted by Hester, he casually glanced across during the next break in the conversation to see the man's demon, a snowy owl, glaring at him with bright orange eyes. Well, that was what owls looked like, and they did stare. But Hester was right, and there was a hostility and suspicion in the demon that the man's face showed nothing of. And then Lee saw something else. The Skraeling was wearing a ring with the church's symbol engraved on it. Suddenly he realized the reason for the man's silence. Every philosophical research establishment, so he'd heard, had to include on its staff a representative of the magisterium, to act as a censor and suppress the news of any heretical discoveries. So realizing this, and remembering something he'd heard Lyra say, Lee asked,
tell me, gentlemen, do you happen to know if Grumman ever looked into the question of dust?
And instantly a silence fell in the stuffy little room. Everyone's attention focused on the Skraeling, though no one looked at him directly. Lee knew that Hester would remain inscrutable, with her eyes half-closed and her ears flat along her back, and he put on a cheerful innocence as he looked from face to face. Finally, he settled on the Skraeling and said,
I beg your pardon.
Have I asked about something it's forbidden to know?
Where did you hear mention of this subject, Mr. Scoresby?
From a passenger I flew across the sea a while back. They never said what it was, but from the way it was mentioned, it seemed like the kind of thing Dr. Grumman might have inquired into. I took it to be some kind of celestial thing, like the aurora. But it puzzled me, because as an aeronaut, I know the skies pretty well, and I'd never come across this stuff. What is it, anyhow?
As you say, a celestial phenomenon. It has no practical significance.
Presently, Lee decided it was time to leave. He had learned no more, and he didn't want to keep Umak waiting. He left the astronomers to their fog-bound observatory and set off down the track, feeling his way along by following his demon, whose eyes were closer to the ground. And when they were only 10 minutes down the path, something swept past his head in the fog and dived at Hester. It was the Skraeling's owl demon. But Hester sensed her coming and flattened herself in time, and the owl's claws just missed. Hester could fight. Her claws were sharp, too, and she was tough and brave. Lee knew that the Skraeling himself must be close by, and reached for the revolver at his belt.
"Behind you, Lee,"
Hester said, and he whipped around, diving as an arrow hissed over his shoulder. He fired at once. The Skraeling fell, grunting as the bullet thudded into his leg. A moment later, the owl demon, wheeling on silent wings, swooped with a clumsy, fainting movement to his side, and half lay on the snow, struggling to fold her wings. Lee Scoresby cocked his pistol and held it to the man's head.
"Right, you damn fool. What did you try that for? Can't you see we're all in the same trouble now this thing's happened to the sky?
It's too late."
"Too late for what?"
"Too late to stop. I have already sent a messenger bird. The Magisterium will know of your inquiries, and they will be glad to know about Grumman."
"What about him?"
"The fact that others are looking for him. It confirms what we thought, and that others know of dust. You are an enemy of the Church, Lee Scoresby. By their fruits shall ye know them. By their questions shall ye see the serpent gnawing at their heart."
The owl was making soft, hooting noises and raising and dropping her wings fitfully. Her bright orange eyes were filming over with pain. There was a gathering red stain in the snow around the Skraeling. Even in the fog-thick dimness, Lee could see that the man was going to die.
"Reckon my bullet must have hit an artery. Let go my sleeve and I'll make a tourniquet."
"No, I am glad to die. I shall have the martyr's palm. You will not deprive me of that."
"Then die if you want to. Just tell me this."
But he never had the chance to complete his question, because with a bleak little shiver, the owl demon disappeared. The Skraeling's soul was gone. Lee had once seen a painting in which a saint of the Church was shown being attacked by assassins. While they bludgeoned his dying body, the saint's demon was borne upward by cherubs and offered a spray of palm, the badge of a martyr. The Skraeling's face now bore the same expression as the saint's in the picture, an ecstatic straining towards oblivion. Lee dropped him in distaste. Hester clicked her tongue.
"Should have reckoned he'd send a message. Take his ring."
"What the hell for? We ain't thieves, are we?"
"No, we're renegades. Not by our choice, but by his malice. Once the Church learns about this, we're done for anyway. Take every advantage we can in the meantime. Go on, take the ring and stow it away, and maybe we can use it."
Lee saw the sense and took the ring off the dead man's finger. Peering into the gloom, he saw that the path was edged by a steep drop into rocky darkness, and he rolled the Skraeling's body over. It fell for a long time before he heard any impact. Lee had never enjoyed violence, and he hated killing, although he'd had to do it 3 times before.
"No sense in thinking that. He didn't give us a choice, and we didn't shoot to kill. Damn it, Lee, he wanted to die. These people are insane."
"I guess you're right,"
he said, and put the pistol away. At the foot of the path, they found the driver, with the dogs harnessed and ready to move.
"Tell me, Umak,"
Lee said as they set off back to the fish packing station.
"You ever hear of a man called Grumman?"
"Oh, sure. Everybody know Dr. Grumman."
"Did you know he had a Tartar name?"
"Not Tartar. You mean Topari? Not Tartar."
"What happened to him? Is he dead?"
"You ask me that, I have to say I don't know. So you'll never know the truth from me."
"I see. So who can I ask?"
"You better ask his tribe. Better go to Yenisei. Ask them."
"His tribe?
You mean the people who initiated him? Who drilled his skull?
Yes. You better ask them. Maybe he not dead. Maybe he is. Maybe neither dead nor alive.
How can he be neither dead nor alive?
In spirit world. Maybe he in spirit world. Already I say too much. Say no more now.
And he did not. But when they returned to the station, Lee went at once to the docks and looked for a ship that could give him passage to the mouth of the Yenisei. Meanwhile, the witches were searching too. The Latvian queen, Ruta Skadi, flew with Serafina Pekala's company for many days and nights, through fog and whirlwind, over regions devastated by flood or landslide. It was certain that they were in a world none of them had known before, with strange winds, strange scents in the air, great unknown birds that attacked them on sight and had to be driven off with volleys of arrows. And when they found land to rest on, the very plants were strange. Still, some of those plants were edible, and they found rabbits that made a tasty meal, and there was no shortage of water. It might have been a good land to live in, but for the spectral forms that drifted like mist over the grasslands and congregated near streams and low-lying water. In some lights they were hardly there at all, just visible as a drifting quality in the light, a rhythmic evanescence, like veils of transparency turning before a mirror. The witches had never seen anything like them before, and mistrusted them at once.
"Are they alive, do you think, Serafina Pekala?"
said Ruta Skadi as the witches circled high above a group of the things that stood motionless at the edge of a tract of forest.
"Alive or dead, they're full of malice. I can feel that from here. And unless I knew what weapon could harm them, I wouldn't want to go closer than this."
The spectres seemed to be earthbound, without the power of flight, luckily for the witches. Later that day, they saw what the spectres could do. It happened at a river crossing, where a dusty road went over a low stone bridge beside a stand of trees. The late afternoon sun slanted across the grassland, drawing an intense green out of the ground and a dusty gold out of the air. And in that rich oblique light the witches saw a band of travellers making for the bridge, some on foot, some in horse-drawn carts, two of them riding horses. Serafina caught her breath. These people had no demons, and yet they seemed alive. She was about to fly down and look more closely when she heard a cry of alarm. It came from the rider on the leading horse. He was pointing at the trees, and as the witches looked down, they saw a stream of those spectral forms pouring across the grass, seeming to flow with no effort toward the people, their prey. The people scattered. Serafina was shocked to see the leading rider turn tail at once and gallop away, without staying to help his comrades, and the second rider did the same, escaping as fast as he could in another direction.
"Fly lower and watch, sisters, but don't interfere until I command."
They saw that the little band contained children as well, some riding in the carts, some walking beside them. And it was clear that the children couldn't see the spectres, and the spectres weren't interested in them. They made instead for the adults. One old woman seated on a cart held two little children on her lap, and Ruta Skadi was angered by her cowardice, because she tried to hide behind them and thrust them out towards the spectre that approached her, as if offering them up to save her own life. The children pulled free of the old woman and jumped down from the cart, and now, like the other children around them, ran to and fro in fright, or stood and clung together weeping as the spectres attacked the adults. The old woman in the cart was soon enveloped in a transparent shimmer that moved busily, working and feeding in some invisible way that made Ruta Skadi sick to watch. The same fate befell every adult in the party apart from the two who had fled on their horses. Fascinated and stunned, Serafina Pekala flew down even closer. There was a father with his child who had tried to ford the river to get away, but a spectre had caught up with them, and as the child clung to the father's back, crying, the man slowed down and stood waist-deep in the water, arrested and helpless. What was happening to him? Serafina hovered above the water a few feet away, gazing, horrified. She had heard from travellers in her own world of the legend of the vampire, and she thought of that as she watched the spectre busy gorging on something, some quality the man had, his soul, his demon perhaps. For in this world, evidently, demons were inside, not outside. His arms slackened under the child's thighs, and the child fell into the water behind him and grabbed vainly at his hand, gasping, crying. But the man only turned his head slowly and looked down with perfect indifference at his little son, drowning beside him. That was too much for Serafina. She swooped lower and plucked the child from the water, and as she did so, Ruta Skadi cried out,
"Be careful, sister!
Behind you!
And Seraphina felt just for a moment a hideous dullness at the edge of her heart, and reached out and up for Rutaskadi's hand, which pulled her away from the danger. They flew higher, the child screaming and clinging to her waist with sharp fingers, and Seraphina saw the specter behind her, a drift of mist swirling on the water, casting about for its lost prey. Rutaskadi shot an arrow into the heart of it with no effect at all. Seraphina put the child down on the riverbank, seeing that it was in no danger from the specters, and they retreated to the air again. The little band of travellers had halted for good now. The horses cropped the grass or shook their heads at flies. The children were howling or clutching one another and watching from a distance, and every adult had fallen still. Their eyes were open. Some were standing, though most had sat down, and a terrible stillness hung over them. As the last of the specters drifted away, sated, Seraphina flew down and alighted in front of a woman sitting on the grass, a strong, healthy-looking woman whose cheeks were red and whose fair hair was glossy.
Woman!
There was no response.
Can you hear me? Can you see me?
She shook her shoulder. With an immense effort, the woman looked up. She scarcely seemed to notice. Her eyes were vacant, and when Seraphina pinched the skin of her forearm, she merely looked down slowly and then away again. The other witches were moving through the scattered wagons, looking at the victims in dismay. The children, meanwhile, were gathering on a little knoll some way off, staring at the witches and whispering together fearfully.
"The horseman's watching,"
said a witch. She pointed up to where the road led through a gap in the hills. The rider who'd fled had reined in his horse and turned around to look back, shading his eyes to see what was going on.
"We'll speak to him,"
said Seraphina, and sprang into the air. However the man had behaved when faced with the specters, he was no coward. As he saw the witches approach, he unslung the rifle from his back and kicked the horse forward onto the grass, where he could wheel and fire and face them in the open. But Seraphina Pekala alighted slowly and held her bow out before laying it on the ground in front of her. Whether or not they had that gesture here, its meaning was unmistakable. The man lowered the rifle from his shoulder and waited, looking from Seraphina to the other witches, and up to their demons, too, who circled in the skies above. Women, young and ferocious, dressed in scraps of black silk and riding pine branches through the sky. There was nothing like that in his world, but he faced them with calm wariness. Seraphina, coming closer, saw sorrow in his face as well, and strength. It was hard to reconcile with the memory of his turning tail and running while his companions perished.
"Who are you?"
"My name is Seraphina Pekala. I am the queen of the witches of Lake Anara, which is in another world. What is your name?"
"Joachim Lorenz. Witches, you say? Do you treat with the devil, then?"
"If we did, would that make us your enemy?"
He thought for a few moments and settled his rifle across his thighs.
"It might have done once, but times have changed. Why have you come to this world?"
"Because the times have changed. What are those creatures who attacked your party?"
"Well, the specters,"
he said, shrugging, half astonished.
"Don't you know the specters?"
"We've never seen them in our world. We saw you making your escape and we didn't know what to think. Now I understand."
"There's no defense against them. Only the children are untouched. Every party of travelers has to include a man and a woman on horseback by law. And they have to do what we did, or else the children will have no one to look after them. But times are bad now. The cities are thronged with specters. And there used to be no more than a dozen or so in each place."
Rutaskadi was looking around. She noticed the other rider moving back towards the wagons, and saw that it was indeed a woman. The children were running to meet her.
"But tell me what you're looking for. You didn't answer me before. You wouldn't have come here for nothing. Answer me now."
"We're looking for a child, a young girl from our world. Her name is Lyra Belacqua, called Lyra Silvertongue. But where she might be in a whole world we can't guess. You haven't seen a strange child on her own?"
"No, but we saw angels the other night, making for the pole."
"Angels?"
"Troops of them in the air, armed and shining. They haven't been so common in the last years. Though in my grandfather's time they passed through this world often, or so he used to say."
He shaded his eyes and gazed down toward the scattered wagons, the halted travelers. The other rider had dismounted now and was comforting some of the children. Seraphina followed his gaze and said,
"If we camp with you tonight and keep guard against the specters,
Will you tell us more about this world and these angels you saw?
Certainly I will. Come with me.
The witches helped to move the wagons farther along the road, over the bridge and away from the trees where the specters had come from. The stricken adults had to stay where they were, though it was painful to see the little children clinging to a mother who no longer responded to them, or tugging the sleeve of a father who said nothing and gazed into nothing and had nothing in his eyes. The younger children couldn't understand why they had to leave their parents. The older ones, some of whom had already lost parents of their own and who had seen it before, simply looked bleak and stayed dumb. Serafina picked up the little boy who'd fallen in the river and who was crying out for his daddy, reaching back over Serafina's shoulder to the silent figure still standing in the water, indifferent. Serafina felt his tears on her bare skin. The horsewoman, who wore rough canvas breeches and rode like a man, said nothing to the witches. Her face was grim. She moved the children on, speaking sternly, ignoring their tears. The evening sun suffused the air with a golden light in which every detail was clear and nothing was dazzling, and the faces of the children and the man and woman, too, seemed immortal and strong and beautiful. Later, as the embers of a fire glowed in a circle of ashy rocks and the great hills lay calm under the moon, Joachim Lorenz told Serafina and Rutaskadi about the history of his world. It had once been a happy one, he explained. The cities were spacious and elegant, the fields well-tilled and fertile. Merchant ships plied to and fro on the blue oceans, and fishermen hauled in brimming nets of cod and tunny, bass and mullet. The forests ran with game, and no children went hungry. In the courts and squares of the great cities, ambassadors from Brazil and Benin, from Ireland and Korea, mingled with tobacco sellers, with commedia players from Bergamo, with dealers in fortune bonds. At night, masked lovers met under the rose-hung colonnades or in the lamplit gardens, and the air stirred with the scent of jasmine and throbbed to the music of the wire-strung mandarone. The witches listened wide-eyed to this tale of a world so like theirs, and yet so different.
But it went wrong. 300 years ago, it all went wrong. Some people reckon the Philosopher's Guild of the Torre degli Angeli, the Tower of the Angels, in the city we have just left, they're the ones to blame. Others say it was a judgment on us for some great sin, though I never heard any agreement about what that sin was. But suddenly, out of nowhere, there came the specters, and we've been haunted ever since. You've seen what they do. Now, imagine what it is to live in a world with specters in it. How can we prosper when we can't rely on anything continuing as it is? At any moment, a father might be taken, or a mother, and the family fall apart. A merchant might be taken, and his enterprise fail, and all his clerks and factors lose their employment. And how can lovers trust their vows? All the trust and all the virtue fell out of our world when the specters came.
Who are these philosophers, and where is this tower you speak of?
In the city we left, Citagazze, the city of magpies. You know why it's called that? Because magpies steal, and that's all we can do now. We create nothing. We have built nothing. For hundreds of years, all we can do is steal from other worlds. Oh, yes, we know about other worlds. Those philosophers in the Torre degli Angeli discovered all we need to know about that subject. They have a spell, which, if you say it, lets you walk through a door that isn't there and find yourself in another world. Some say it's not a spell, but a key that can open even where there isn't a lock. Who knows? Whatever it is, it let the specters in. And the philosophers use it still, I understand. They pass into other worlds and steal from them and bring back what they find. Gold and jewels, of course, but other things, too, like ideas, or sacks of corn, or pencils. They are the source of all our wealth, that guild of thieves.
Why don't the spectres harm children?
Asked Rutaskadi.
That is the greatest mystery of all. In the innocence of children, there's some power that repels the spectres of indifference. But it's more than that. Children simply don't see them, though we can't understand why. We never have. But spectre orphans are common, as you can imagine. Children whose parents have been taken, they gather in bands and roam the country, and sometimes they hire themselves out to adults to look for food and supplies in a spectre-ridden area. And sometimes they simply drift about and scavenge. So, that is our world. Or we manage to live with this curse. They're true parasites. They won't kill their host, though they drain most of their life out of him. But there was a rough balance. Till recently. Till the great storm. Such a storm it was. It sounded as if the whole world was breaking and cracking apart. There hadn't been a storm like that in memory. And then there came a fog that lasted for days and covered every part of the world that I know of, and no one could travel. And when the fog cleared, the cities were full of the specters, hundreds and thousands of them. So we fled to the hills and out to sea. But there's no escaping them this time, wherever we go, as you saw for yourselves. Now it's your turn. You tell me about your world, and why you have left it to come to this one.
Serafina told him truthfully as much as she knew. He was an honest man, and there was nothing that needed concealing from him. He listened closely, shaking his head with wonder, and when she had finished, he said,
I told you about the power they say our philosophers have of opening the way to other worlds. Well, some think that occasionally they leave a doorway open out of forgetfulness. I wouldn't be surprised if travelers from other worlds found their way here from time to time. We know that angels pass through, after all.
Angels? You mentioned them before. They are new to us. Can you explain them?
You want to know about angels? Very well. Their name for themselves is Bene Elim, I'm told. Some call them watchers, too. They're not beings of flesh like us. They're beings of spirit. Or maybe their flesh is more finely drawn than ours, lighter and clearer. I wouldn't know. But they're not like us. They carry messages from heaven. That's their calling. We see them sometimes in the sky, passing through this world on the way to another, shining like fireflies, way, way up high. On a still night, you can even hear their wing beats. They have concerns different from ours, though in the ancient days they came down and had dealings with men and women. And they bred with us too, some say. And when the fog came, after the great storm, I was beset by specters in the hills behind the city of Santalia, on my way homeward. I took refuge in a shepherd's hut by a spring next to a birch wood, and all night long I heard voices above me in the fog, cries of alarm and anger, and wing beats, too, closer than I had ever heard them before. And towards dawn, there was the sound of a skirmish of arms, the whoosh of arrows, and the clang of swords. I daredn't go out and see, though I was powerfully curious, for I was afraid. I was stark terrified, if you want to know. When the sky was as light as it ever got during that fog, I ventured to look out, and I saw a great figure lying wounded by the spring. I felt as if I was seeing things I had no right to see. Sacred things. I had to look away. And when I looked again, the figure was gone. That's the closest I ever came to an angel. But, as I told you, we saw them the other night, way high aloft among the stars, making for the pole, like a fleet of mighty ships under sail. Something is happening, and we don't know down here what it may be. There could be a war breaking out. There was a war in heaven once, oh, thousands of years ago, immense ages back, but I don't know what the outcome was. It wouldn't be impossible if there was another. But the devastation would be enormous, and the consequences for us... I can't imagine it. Though,
he went on, sitting up to stir the fire,
the end of it might be better than I fear. It might be that a war in heaven would sweep the specters from this world altogether, and back into the pit they come from. What a blessing that would be, eh? How fresh and happy we could live, free of that fearful blight.
Though Joachim Lorenz looked anything but hopeful as he stared into the flames. The flickering light played over his face, but there was no play of expression in his strong features. He looked grim and sad. Ruta Skadi said,
"The pole, sir. You said these angels were making for the pole. Why would they do that, do you know? Is that where heaven lies?"
"I couldn't say. I'm not a learned man. You can see that plain enough. But the north of our world, well, that's the abode of spirits, they say. If angels were mustering, that's where they'd go. And if they were going to make an assault on heaven, I dare say that's where they'd build their fortress and sally out from."
He looked up, and the witches followed his eyes. The stars in this world were the same as theirs. The Milky Way blazed bright across the dome of the sky, and innumerable points of starlight dusted the dark, almost matching the moon for brightness.
"Sir, did you ever hear of dust?"
"Dust? I guess you mean it in some other sense than the dust on the roads. No, I never did. But look, there's a troop of angels now."
He pointed to the constellation of Ophiuchus. And sure enough, something was moving through it, a tiny cluster of lighted beings. And they didn't drift. They moved with a purposeful flight of geese or swans. Ruta Skadi stood up.
"Sister, it's time I parted from you. I'm going up to speak to these angels, whatever they may be. If they're going to Lord Asriel, I'll go with them. If not, I'll search on by myself. Thank you for your company, and go well."
They kissed, and Ruta Skadi took her cloud pine branch and sprang into the air. Her demon, Sergi, a blue-throat, sped out of the dark alongside her.
"We're going high?"
"As high as those lighted flyers in Ophiuchus. They're going swiftly, Sergi. Let's catch them."
And she and her demon raced upward, flying quicker than sparks from a fire, the air rushing through the twigs on her branch and making her black hair stream out behind. She didn't look back at the little fire in the wide darkness, at the sleeping children and her witch companions. That part of her journey was over. And besides, those glowing creatures ahead of her were no larger yet, and unless she kept her eye on them, they were easily lost against the great expanse of starlight. So she flew on, never losing sight of the angels, and gradually, as she came closer, they took on a clearer shape. They shone, not as if they were burning, but as if, wherever they were and however dark the night, sunlight was shining on them. They were like humans, but winged, and much taller. And as they were naked, the witch could see that three of them were male, two female. Their wings sprang from their shoulder blades, and their backs and chests were deeply muscled. Ruta Skadi stayed behind them for some way, watching, measuring their strength in case she should need to fight them. They weren't armed, but on the other hand they were flying easily within their power, and might even outstrip her if it came to a chase. Making her bow ready, just in case, she sped forward and flew alongside them, calling,
"Angels, halt and listen to me. I am the witch Ruta Skadi, and I want to talk to you."
They turned. Their great wings beat inward, slowing them, and their bodies swung downward till they were standing upright in the air, holding their position by the beating of their wings. They surrounded her, five huge forms glowing in the dark air, lit by an invisible sun. She looked around, sitting on her pine branch, proud and unafraid, though her heart was beating with the strangeness of it, and her demon fluttered to sit close to the warmth of her body. Each angel being was distinctly an individual, and yet they had more in common with one another than with any human she had seen. What they shared was a shimmering, darting play of intelligence and feeling that seemed to sweep over them all simultaneously. They were naked, but she felt naked in front of their glance. It was so piercing and went so deep. Still, she was unashamed of what she was, and she returned their gaze with head held high.
So you are angels, or watchers, or Bene Elim. Where are you going?
We are following the call.
She was not sure which one had spoken. It might have been any or all of them at once.
Whose call?
A man's.
Lord Asriel's?
It may be.
Why are you following his call?
Because we are willing to.
Then wherever he is, you can guide me to him as well.
Ruta Skadi was 416 years old, with all the pride and knowledge of an adult witch queen. She was wiser by far than any short-lived human, but she had not the slightest idea of how like a child she seemed beside these ancient beings. Nor did she know how far their awareness spread out beyond her, like filamentary tentacles to the remotest corners of universes she had never dreamed of. Nor that she saw them as human-formed only because her eyes expected to. If she were to perceive their true form, they would seem more like architecture than organism, like huge structures composed of intelligence and feeling. But they expected nothing else. She was very young. At once they beat their wings and surged forward, and she darted with them, surfing on the turbulence their pinions caused in the air, and relishing the speed and power it added to her flight. They flew throughout the night. The stars wheeled around them, and faded and vanished as the dawn seeped up from the east. The world burst into brilliance as the sun's rim appeared, and then they were flying through blue sky and clear air, fresh and sweet and moist. In the daylight the angels were less visible, though to any eye their strangeness was clear. The light Ruta Skadi saw them by was still not that of the sun now climbing the sky, but some other light from somewhere else. Tirelessly they flew on, and tirelessly she kept pace. She felt a fierce joy possessing her that she could command these immortal presences, and she rejoiced in her blood and flesh, in the rough pine bark she felt next to her skin, in the beat of her heart and the life of all her senses, and in the hunger she was feeling now, and in the presence of her sweet-voiced blue-throat demon, and in the earth below her, and the lives of every creature, plant and animal both. And she delighted in being of the same substance as them, and in knowing that when she died her flesh would nourish other lives as they had nourished her. And she rejoiced, too, that she was going to see Lord Asriel again. Another night came, and still the angels flew on. And at some point the quality of the air changed, not for the worse or the better, but changed nonetheless, and Ruta Skadi knew that they'd passed out of that world and into another. How it had happened, she couldn't guess.
Angels!
She called as she sensed the change.
How have we left the world I found you in? Where was the boundary?
There are invisible places in the air, gateways into other worlds. We can see them, but you cannot.
Ruta Skadi couldn't see the invisible gateway, but she didn't need to. Witches could navigate better than birds. As soon as the angel spoke, she fixed her attention on three jagged peaks below her and memorized their configuration exactly. Now she could find it again if she needed to, despite what the angels might think. They flew on farther, and presently she heard an angel voice.
Lord Asriel is in this world, and there is the fortress he's building.
They had slowed, and were circling like eagles in the middle airs. Ruta Skadi looked where one angel was pointing. The first faint glimmer of light was tinting the east, though all the stars above shone as brilliantly as ever against the profound velvet black of the high heavens. And on the very rim of the world, where the light was increasing moment by moment, a great mountain range reared its peaks, jagged spears of black rock, mighty broken slabs, and saw-tooth ridges piled in confusion like the wreckage of a universal catastrophe. But on the highest point, which as she looked was touched by the first rays of the morning sun and outlined in brilliance, stood a regular structure. A huge fortress whose battlements were formed of single slabs of basalt, half a hill in height, and whose extent was to be measured in flying time. Beneath this colossal fortress, fires glared and furnaces smoked in the darkness of early dawn, and from many miles away Ruta Skadi heard the clang of hammers and the pounding of great mills. And from every direction she could see more flights of angels winging toward it, and not only angels but machines too, steel-winged craft gliding like albatrosses, glass cabins under flickering dragonfly wings, droning zeppelins like huge bumblebees, all making for the fortress that Lord Asriel was building on the mountains at the edge of the world.
And is Lord Asriel there?
Yes, he is there.
Then let's fly there to meet him. and you must be my guard of honor.
Obediently they spread their wings and set their course toward the gold-rimmed fortress, with the eager witch flying before them. Chapter 7 The Rolls-Royce. Lyra woke early to find the morning quiet and warm, as if the city never had any other weather than this calm summer. She slipped out of bed and downstairs, and hearing some children's voices out on the water, went to see what they were doing. Three boys and a girl were splashing across the sunlit harbour in a couple of pedal boats, racing towards the steps. As they saw Lyra, they slowed for a moment, but then the race took hold of them again. The winners crashed into the steps so hard that one of them fell into the water, and then he tried to climb into the other craft and tipped that over too, and then they all splashed about together as if the fear of the night before had never happened. They were younger than most of the children by the tower, Lyra thought, and she joined them in the water, with Pantalaimon as a little silver fish glittering beside her. She never found it hard to talk to other children, and soon they were gathered around her, sitting in pools of water on the warm stone, their shirts drying quickly in the sun. Poor Pantalaimon had to creep into her pocket again, frog-shaped in the cool, damp cotton.
What are you going to do with that cat?
Can you really take the bad luck away?
Where you come from?
Your friend, he ain't afraid of spectres.
We ain't afraid of anything, nor am I. What are you scared of cats for?
You don't know about cats. Cats, they got the devil in them, all right. You gotta kill every cat you see. They bite you and put the devil in you, too. And what was he doing with that big pard?
She realized he meant Pantalaimon in his leopard shape and shook her head innocently.
You must have been dreaming. There's all kinds of things look different in the moonlight. But me and Will, we don't have spectres where we come from, so we don't know much about them.
If you can't see them, you're safe. You see them, you know they can get you. That's what my pa said. Then they got him.
And they're here, all around us now.
Yeah,
said the girl. She reached out a hand and grabbed a fistful of air, crowing,
I got one now! They can't hurt you, so we can't hurt them, all right?
And there's always been spectres in this world.
Yeah. No, they came a long time ago, hundreds of years.
They came because of the guild.
The what?
They never. My granny said they came because people were bad, and God sent them to punish us.
Your granny don't know nothing. She got a beard, your granny. She's a goat, all right?
What's the guild?
You know the Torre degli Angeli, the stone tower, right? Well, it belongs to the guild, and there's a secret place in there. The guild, they're men who know all kind of things. Philosophy, alchemy, all kind of things they know. And they were the ones who let the spectres in.
That ain't true. They come from the stars.
It is. This is what happened, all right? This guild man, hundreds of years ago, was taking some metal apart. Lead. He was going to make it into gold. And he cut it and cut it, smaller and smaller, till he came to the smallest piece he could get. There ain't nothing small in that. So small, you couldn't see it even. But he cut that too. And inside the smallest little bit, there was all the spectres packed in, twisted over and folded up, so tight they took up no space at all. But once he cut it, bam! They washed out and they've been here ever since. That's what my papa said.
Is there any guild men in the tower now?
No, they've run away like everyone else.
There ain't no one in the tower. That's haunted, that place. That's why the cat came from there. We ain't gonna go in there, all right? Ain't no kids gonna go in there. That's scary.
The guild men ain't afraid to go in there.
They got special magic or something. They're greedy. They live off the poor people. The poor people do all the work, and the guild men just live there for nothing.
But there ain't anyone in the tower now. No grown-ups.
No grown-ups in the city at all.
They wouldn't dare, all right?
But she had seen a young man up there. She was convinced of it. And there was something in the way these children spoke. As a practiced liar, she knew liars when she met them, and they were lying about something. And suddenly she remembered. Little Paolo had mentioned that he and Angelica had an elder brother, Tullio, who was in the city too, and Angelica had hushed him. Could the young man she'd seen have been their brother? She left them to rescue their boats and pedal back to the beach, and went inside to make some coffee and see if Will was awake. But he was still asleep, with the cat curled up at his feet, and Lyra was impatient to see her scholar again. So she wrote a note and left it on the floor by his bedside, and took her rucksack and went off to look for the window. The way she took led her through the little square they'd come to the night before.